Periodically, we dedicate one of our Wednesday night Dharma meetings to opportunity for people to pose questions about Buddhist doctrine, the concepts of Buddhism, and the practice. Kind of take on a coaching persona then, in terms of what's happening with your meditation practice, and let's talk about how to advance it. So we're doing that again tonight. Open for questions or comments at this point about your about the doctrine or your practice. If you're just beginning to meditate, please ask questions. I'm very knowledgeable about this. I've been teaching a very long time. Don't worry about whether your question is too simple or uninformed. Trust me, that will open the door to all kinds of interesting thoughts and exchanges.
I have fun request. Sorry. Like you.
Satish, yes.
To me, it would be helpful if we do not use the Pali phrases. Because that throw me off, but just a request.
Well, the reason why I use them
Yeah.
is part of it is out of consideration for the this constructed language. It's like Latin, but there the intention behind the words I find to be very interesting. I was an English major, minored in philosophy, so I'm really interested in what happens in terms in the mind in regarding the words and emotions. So the Buddha was really, I think, brilliant in repurposing some terminology, and I want to respect that. And it gives me a chance to talk about it, to kind of dive into the concept. Robert, you had something?
Well, I was just going to say, you said last week, don't abandon your Vipassana practice, and I took your advice. It's actually going extremely well, which is a surprise because I thought, well, I won't do that. I'll just do watching the mind. But it's surprising how. But I wanted to ask you. Do you do the whole session doing the body scanning, or do you, once you've reached a settled point, do you stop the body scanning and just wait? Or, because I found that's what was happening just now.
What was just happening just now?
Was reaching a point where it was suggesting just to wait and sit in the stillness and the centeredness. Now, I mean, I could easily have gone on body scanning, but I mean,
There's stillness and centeredness there too. In the body scanning, there's stillness and
yeah,
and
sure,
stability there also.
mean, what I've been doing is tend to start watching the breath in and out the nose for 5, 10 minutes. But also, I'm visualizing a candle flame, which I can sort of hold for a long time as a dual thing.
Visualize what?
A kind of picture of a candle flame. I mean, it's just something that's happened, and then go into the body scanning.
The whole practice is to cultivate a heightened degree of introspective awareness. And what I mean by degree, in terms of undistractedness and stability. And still stability, when I say stability, I mentioned stillness. There's a quality of attention that is coexisting or underlying any kind of internal commentary or any kind of body scanning. In other words, there's an assigned task, so to speak. Same thing is true with mindfulness of breathing. There's an assigned task, right? Now, with a candle flame, you've assigned a task to that. So that creates a certain kind of stability and non-reactive stillness. And then you just wait and keep letting go and opening, releasing, releasing, relaxing. I do that particularly with the out-breath. And I'm not saying that I do that in a structured way. I start out with, when I watch the breath, I've mentioned this before, I'm watching the sensation that occurs when the air hits the inside of the roof of the mouth by the teeth and the inner side of the upper lip, both the in-breath and the out-breath, and also whatever might be happening in the front of the lips and in the nose. So that whole area there, I'm very intentional about that. And then for tonight's sitting, I did a body scan or open body awareness some small period of time. But for the most part, it was just here, okay, like I just described it. And of course, the mind wanders, right? But I just notice it and go back to that process. But the body scanning, you know, there's a procedural approach to cultivating intentional awareness. You give yourself an assignment. You notice the sensations in this part of the body, then another part, and another part. And you just keep doing that. You do it more and more quickly. In other words, it might take, when I'm on a retreat, I will do a very systematic practice for a while. When I say for a while, a day or so, right? And what that's doing is building that intentionality. And then as that process becomes more routine, what happens is I keep letting go with the out-breath. It just seems so right to just keep softening and opening with the out-breath. And it might go on for a very long time before the in-breath occurs again. Very stable and quiet and peaceful, right? And that the intention that was stabilized, clarified with the breath or the body scanning, now is stable and non-reactively aware of just simply the whole process of selfing. And like you've heard me say, whatever the storyline is, it's in the other room with the door closed. Part of me is aware that there's some kind of chatterbox thing going on, but it's very faint and not important. But then there's this stillness that I'm really interested in. Now, that doesn't happen very much. It might happen briefly on a sitting in the morning or at night. I sit twice a day. But on the retreats, I really want to try to cultivate access to that zone for an extended period of time to see what happens. Just curiosity. Does that clarify?
So you will use a combination of techniques.
All of them meant to cultivate intentional awareness in a non-reactive, introspective way.
And instinct, you'll watch the breath on the nostrils or inside your mouth, and then
It's
as
a legitimate practice to watch the expanding, contracting of the abdomen. That's a very well-respected practice also.
and you combine that with the Vipassana body scanning as well
Yeah,
as the
the body
movement.
scanning is called Vedanupassana. Vipassana is just simply being aware of impermanence and non-self and the nature of craving and clinging. I love these kind of questions. Questions from anyone about the doctrine or about your practice?
Yeah, I'll
John?
attempt one. I'll attempt a question if I could. During this 45 minutes sit, see, I'm getting feedback, but so there, I'm new to meditation. I'm not sure why I'm getting feedback. Anyway, oh, because of you. Marky, can you turn yours off for a sec? I'm
That's
sorry.
probably it, Mark. It's probably Mark's. It's going to cause that.
Yeah.
HD.
No, I got it. Here. All I want to say is sorry, everyone. I really apologize. All I wanted to say is not, I can follow the breath. I get it, but I get what I wanted to, what I really noticed today, this 45 minutes hit. I noticed it earlier too. I have these emotions. It's almost like, you people talk about, people mention, look, watch the thoughts. I have emotions more than I do thinking. And the issue is those emotions will grab me by the hair I don't have. They're so, it's I can't, I mean, it's just, it's, I mean, what I wanted to ask you was, okay, how do I know I'm doing this right? The obvious question everyone asks. And I've been, I haven't been meditating long, 5 or 6 years I've been trying to. But I mean, like, I mean, how do you, I mean, today's meditation, you wouldn't believe the things that were going on in my mind, But no, you, it was, it was sexual, it was everything. I mean, it was just like wild. And but see, some of it, but I made a commitment to sit for 45 minutes and I tried to watch the breath. But see, it's hard. It's really hard to trust that I'm not going down some cul-de-sac that's going to lead, to.
You just notice the cul-de-sac and reboot the system. That's the practice. I mean,
Yeah. It's hard
it.
to trust that. That's all.
Well, what I'm inviting you to develop confidence in, and confidence is one of the factors that Buddhism emphasizes. And the confidence, the faith, doesn't come from some outside source. It's a confidence that you understand what's going on and you can respond to it more or less skillfully. So, in the context of what you're saying, the idea is to understand the process of craving and clinging and liberation from craving and clinging. So, what you're mentioning in terms of the emotional part, I would qualify that as craving. The clinging is the storyline. Okay. Now, I'm making that distinction just for the sake of the conversation. They're blended. Thoughts and feelings are interactive. They're mutually supportive. So the idea is that you develop the process of noticing how craving and clinging operates, its characteristics, right? And let go. And you let go back to breath body awareness relentlessly. One of my early teachers in One of my favorite teachers is Sharon Salzberg. She says that meditation is the art of starting over. And trust me, during this sit tonight, I started over many, many times, but I did not linger as long. And I had a quality of awareness that was not quite so convinced, in the context of whatever captured my attention. You notice and you let go. But what happens when the mind gets quieter, that silence I mentioned, when the storyline is in the other room and I'm just focused on the feeling, I've talked about this before. For some reason, there are nerve endings when I get into some kind of samadhi state, nerve endings around my nose and others elsewhere in my face really fire up. It's this burning, itching, stabbing kind of sensation. And the more I go into the samadhi, the more vivid that awareness is. without a storyline, there's a felt sense of urgency. We can call that emotion. But there's this energy inside that I'm not trying to squash or run away from. I'm just accepting that and trying to keep my balance. And the more I can do that, the less reactive I am to other emotionally charged kinds of experiences. So it's about mastery of a process. It's not about making the mind shut up. Is that helpful?
It's very helpful. And thank goodness I gave up trying to make the mind shut up. So I'm not there. I guess the reason I brought up the emotions, and I'll end real quickly with this. It's almost like getting the rug pulled out from under you. You know, it's like before your mind's even thinking, there's the lizard brain is already. I don't mean to get into his stories, but I wish I could express it to you better. But that was very
great
helpful.
Job.
I appreciate
it. I'm with you, and I'll bet a bunch of other people in this meeting are too.
Thank you.
So the practice conceptually, procedurally, is easy. Mastery of it is challenging. But I find that a very inspiring part of my practice. What's going to happen this time? What's going to happen this time? What's happening now? What's happening now? Right? I don't get bored. There are times when I wonder, it seems that the sitting period is longer, right? But I'm aware, okay, that's just the mind doing that. Keep practicing. So there's less resistance and more active investigative curiosity because of that procedural training. And there's joy in it. And when I say joy, I'm not necessarily it brings a smile to my face. It's that I'm really curious. I'm really interested. This is what's happening. Isn't that interesting? Even if there's this energy inside my body because these nerve endings up here in my face are just really, really intense. And sometimes I just scratch it, you know? So, you know, it's all about process, John. Even the part of your mind that says, damn, I'll never get this. That's part of the practice.
Thank you.
Robert, you have something?
Well, it's difficult to put into words, but the fact that you're meditating, you know that there's going to be a resistance to it. Otherwise, you wouldn't need to meditate. So part of it is, like when I was on the course, I suddenly was getting songs coming in that I have no connection with, or
yep.
I've never liked. I mean, one of them was just bizarre.
Yeah,
wherever it came from, and it kept running
yeah.
in my head. And the assistant teacher, I mentioned this to him, and he said when he goes on the 40-day ones, towards the end, he gets opera coming in, and I apparently stuff that nothing that's well known, but it's just this opera comes into his head at the end of the 40 days. So
I don't know what this fella's experience of opera is or what the connection might be, but I can tell you that when the mind gets really concentrated, there are different kinds of symptoms of concentration. They're called PT, PITI. Sorry, Satish. In my experience, it's like there's a repetitive pattern going on in my consciousness. It's not tinnitus. I've had tinnitus for decades. This is not tinnitus. But sometimes my mind interprets it as a jazz combo. Other times it's operatic.
Oh, right.
Other
Yeah.
times it's blues.
Yeah.
But the mind starts to fall into this recurring analysis of this auditory phenomena that comes up because the mind's very concentrated. It's
Yeah.
kind of mysterious. Other people will experience, like with their eyes closed, a bright light, right? But it just means the mind is concentrated. That might be what this fellow's talking about.
Right. And I suppose depending on what phase of
Your
concentration,
concentration, that's
etc., is
right.
producing
It's
phenomena,
just prior to jhana.
it's depending on the levels that you're going through.
Yep.
Yeah, it's fascinating, I think.
Oh
It,
yeah. That's what I meant. That's why it's
yeah.
what's going to happen this time?
Yeah. Watch it with curiosity.
Yeah.
It's part of coping with it and bringing it under control.
Yeah.
That's not the right word, but yeah.
Christy.
So Peter, can you explain the, can you break down the difference between craving and clinging? Because to my understanding, craving and clinging is what we're striving, we want that, something we want, or we want doesn't necessarily mean something we desire, but maybe we want it to stop happening or whatever. And then the opposite is aversion. Am I right?
Yeah, in psychological terms, it's called affect approach or affect avoidance. It's an instinctual nervous system hormonal response to a stimulation. And the stimulus could either be external or internal. Crazy song lyric, right? But that affect is a felt sense of impulsive reactivity. It's hardwired into the nervous system, right? So the affect approach is desire for a pleasant experience, and affect avoidance is the desire to be rid of an unpleasant experience. That's the craving part. The clinging part is how the mind identifies with what the mind constructs to make sense out of that stimulus. So there's the affective part is simply emotional reactivity. The cognitive part is the story that comes up that's putting that feeling into a context, right? The story can either be dominant or in the background. The feeling, the reactivity can either be dominant or in the background. In the wisdom aggregate of the Eightfold Path is right understanding and right intention. Wrong understanding is identifying with what the mind creates, the cognitive part is being, this is who I am, this is how the world is. The unwise attention our intention part, which is the right intention, the absence of right intention in the wisdom aggregate, is the craving part. So the ability to notice those functions as being impersonal, it's what a brain does. A brain feels and a brain thinks. Just like the lungs take in oxygen and expel CO2. What the lungs do. So realizing the impersonal nature of what's going on in terms of craving and clinging is an important part of the practice. And the ability to notice and let go back into the breath, for the most part, there's no craving and clinging associated with breathing in and breathing out, unless you've got asthma or something. But basically, normal breathing has a minimal amount of craving. So you have to consciously decide to pay attention to that. There's an intention with that. And that simplicity, it also, the breathing in and breathing out does not require any kind of a narrative. There might be just simply a marker, noticing the difference between the in-breath and the out-breath. But when the mind gets really concentrated, that even drops away. There's little or any interest in determining at any given moment whether what you're experiencing is the in-breath or the out-breath. There's just awareness of breath. So that quality of non-reactive introspective awareness, is more capable of realizing what's called nama rupa, which is part of the dependent origination concept structure. But basically, what that means is that nama is what the mind makes. Rupa is sensation. And so in this context, craving is in the realm of rupa, and clinging is in the name, the realm of nama. So being aware of those parts of experience with a degree of detachment, that's what vipassana involves. So I'm kind of throwing a lot at you here. Is this connecting with your question, Christy?
Yeah, I mean it's actually fairly complicated to understand. But I'm always hearing the two together, craving and clinging. And so I
Because
just wanted
they're
to know how to,
cooperative, they
yeah.
feed each other.
I just wanted to know what the, talk about them separately and what they were, the individual ones were. And I think that helps.
Yeah, I mentioned the whole notion of the wisdom aggregate because there's right understanding and right intention. And those are like the two sides of the coin of wisdom. One of them is cognitive, the other one's affective. Although an intention is not really a feeling, but when we can work with feelings and be non-reactive or less reactive, that's very beneficial in terms of the practice of vipassana. And I was kind of alluding to that when I said, when you stay with the breath, it's simple, there's minimal craving or clinging involved. So that provides a home base, a stabilizing point of reference, so that the mind is less hooked, less likely to be hooked. Is that helpful?
You.
Mark.
Hi, thanks, Peter. I hear you talking about insight into craving and clinging and I guess suffering in general, but sounds like it's primarily your practice is primarily through samadhi or concentration. And there's a lot of disagreement in the Buddhist community about vipassana versus samadhi. And I was wondering how you feel about it in your own practice. How you come, do you feel like that when you're concentrated, the insight comes? Or do you do practice them separately, or it seems like it's almost an amalgamation in your practice. And even the metta, even when you were teaching metta a couple of weeks ago, it was still with the breath and still with the body. I'm just curious about whether you separate those at all or how you put the pieces together.
I have been studying and practicing Buddhism for more than half my life, for probably about 45 years. So I've tried different or been trained in different modalities, different skills. They're all organized around maximizing that introspective awareness of craving and clinging and being able to not to avoid identifying that as a self. So on the side of samadhi, there are two different ways to understand samadhi. One of them involves an exclusive focus of attention. You target something. In this case, it would be a discrete sensation. The recommendation is right around the rim of the nostrils or the upper lip, but a discrete sensation. And you pay attention to that to the exclusion of everything else without interruption for extended periods of time. And that cultivates a very high degree of samadhi, but it's one-pointed, it's exclusive. The other understanding of samadhi is inclusive. And the stability of that form or understanding of samadhi is the mind is stable and non-reactive. There's no special preferred target. There's just present moment awareness that's non-reactive. Now, in the history, the contemporary history, I'll say, going back over 100 years, there had been this, and both of these kind of came out of Burma. One of them is just, was espoused by a fellow named Ledi Sayadaw, and he his person who took his place was Mahasi Sayadaw, and he trained several of the contemporary teachers of Buddhism. And that's the noting method, and that's focusing attention on the expanding contracting of the abdomen. There's no emphasis on cultivating one-pointedness, the jhana practice. It's more about unification, that all the different wholesome factors, the awakening factors, are unified in their functioning, truly cooperative. Then the other school is basically not Upandita. Upandita was in the noting school. I can't remember this teacher's name, but he is a master of jhana. And several contemporary teachers, including Shaila Catherine and others, were trained by him.
That's a pa-oxide, though.
The Pa'ak Sayadaw, thank you. So I got some training from Shaila Catherine in that regard, but I discovered that I'm much more inclined, it's much more understandable, workable for me to cultivate the, use the whole body awareness as a unifying, stabilizing focus of attention. And that creates, like I was saying to Robert, it creates this quiet space inside, this non-reactive space. And I can be more aware of more subtle phenomena going on in the mind. And that's when it starts to get to the point where the out-breath gets really, really soft and kind of fades out. And there's this quiet space. And then the in-breath happens. And it's not like I'm trying to do that. I'm manipulating the breath. It's just what comes with that quality of attention. Now, with the jhana practice, the same thing applies. The mind, the need to breathe becomes less and less important. And the body, there have been times when there have been prolonged periods of time. I didn't time it literally, but I'm sure it was at least several minutes. When I did not breathe in noticeably. And this is well documented in a lot of yogic literature about the mind getting so quiet, there's no perceived need to breathe in and breathe out. But I'm very alert, very comfortable, very non-reactive and stable in that experience. But it comes about because the attention is unified. Is that helpful, Mark?
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Got something, Peter?
Steve and then Satish.
Hey, yeah. So it seems to me that getting into meditation, there's often a desired state for awareness and clarity. And I'm just thinking about all this as we're chatting. But that desire, I guess, is sort of a clinging. So maybe the desire is not a great framework, or the idea of cultivating that awareness and clarity, that could be a preoccupation with clinging or progress. It seems to me like a clear,
Let me interrupt there and say that's when the mind gets really stable and quiet, you can start to notice that kind of subtlety that you just, are curious about.
Oh, that's good to hear. It seems to me that awareness really is a byproduct of acceptance of whatever is going on. You mentioned that earlier. Like, rather than tracking the progress or wanting some deliverance from the things that terrify us or annoy us by day, it seems like the constructive idea here is just mere acceptance, radical acceptance. I need to read that book of whatever's
Good
being,
book. Good book.
whatever's in the moment. Straight acceptance, no chaser.
Well, yeah, but acceptance does not mean being passive. It means a clear acknowledgement of how the mind is making a self in the context of
Sure.
the situation. But it does not
So that
mean,
investigation.
you can't set boundaries interpersonally, or that you can't make a choice about whether to move or not. I know that's something that's quite recent for you.
Yeah, so it's understood it, that's a great articulation for me to sort of keep in mind, is that it's not a passive, like there's an investigation, that's what we always talk about, and you encounter what you investigate, and there's an acceptance of whatever is the result of the investigation. Is that a good way to say it?
Well, you can work with it. It's not like you're fighting it. You may
Right.
not
No
want to
preference.
act on it, but you're aware of it. Maybe there's an awareness of fear. You can be aware of it as a feeling, in a non-reactive way, and discern whether or not that fear is really beneficial or not. A lot of our fear is interpersonal. That's one of the things that's interesting because, we're social primates, and the level of maturity of the human race right now, we react to interpersonal dynamics as if our life depends on it, right? And so our social status becomes an overriding quest, right? And so, learning how to be aware of that fear of social rejection or the desire for being admired, both of those are points of practice, the urgency of it. And you'll be able to experience it in a non-reactive way and decide whether or not you really need to defend yourself or whether or not you really need to buy those new pair of shoes. That helpful?
And what it, yes, and would a part of that practice, important part of that practice, possibly be intentionally subjecting yourself to these social situations that would make you uncomfortable, and having some investigation of that as well.
Well, that's part of the Lojong training, isn't it? You're familiar with the Tibetan Lojong training, right, Steve? You were in that one of those study groups?
I don't think so.
Oh, Oh, okay. Sorry. Anyway, Lojong training is these training points that invite us to cultivate this kind of non-reactive stability and internal awareness, and then bring that to all of our encounters. It's a way to cultivate compassion for yourself and for others. But yes, you put yourself in business situations that might feel awkward socially, but you go there with the intention to deal with the awkwardness, not necessarily to, either be acknowledged as a hero or a villain.
And the recognition afterward that, oh wow, you didn't die.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And their approval or disapproval of you may or may not be all that important, or certainly not as important as your mind makes it.
That delineation between what you project might be your fears, and then it's like, oh, there's not really much of anything here. It's a sort of phantom.
Yep.
Okay.
In fact, one of the training points is regard all dharmas as dreams.
Nice. Wow, that's heavy. Or light, or something.
Satish.
When I meditate, most of the time, my mind is in thoughts. Most of the time. I am able to notice that my mind is off track or thinking of other things. I am able to notice and then momentarily bring it back to my breath. But it's momentarily only, and then it goes back, you know. And that's been there. Well, so I'm hoping just doing what I'm doing, sitting for a few minutes and bringing my attention back to breath is what helps, you know. That's simple, you know, so.
Well, it's a matter of training. And the training involves two different considerations. One of them, how frequently and how long do you train? The other one is, when you are training, are you just going through the motions? Or are you really diligent in the following the training regimen? Okay, so those are the two factors. When I first, when I went on my, well, first of all, what really clarifies this whole process is the immersive experience of being on retreat. It's what you're there to do. And the whole thing is set up to maximize that kind of self-inquiry and training. And so, but when I first started going on retreats back in 1982, the frequency of my meditation practice afterwards, after that first retreat, it fell away. But then I really, that was a transformative experience for my life. So I knew I was going to do it again. And I did it again about 18 months later. Before I went on the second retreat, I started meditating again and then stopped. And that went on for years. Then I went on my first 3 month retreat in 1990. And I have been meditating on a daily basis ever since. And my second run, which was in 2012, I've been meditating twice a day since then. And it grows on you. That's what I'm saying. Because I said I'm curious what's going to happen this time. I am interested in engaging the process. The same thing would be true. Before my second retreat, I stayed with a student. She was in Harvard Divinity School, and I was staying with her in her apartment, and she was learning how to play the cello. And she said, "Here, put this cello between your legs and rub the bow across the chords." My whole body vibrated. So I can imagine, for someone who has mastered or really enjoys playing an instrument like a cello, because it's right up against your body, that could be a very delightful experience. So just list feeling it would be fun, and then being able to do beautiful music with it would add on to that. That's my attitude about my practice, is that. And when I sit, it's not always pleasant. Those itches, they're my most frequent torment these days. It used to be achy knees or whatever. I had sciatica for quite a while. But I worked with it. Now what I'm working with is this sensation in my face. So the ability to work with whatever comes up is what we want to try to cultivate. And the more we can do that, the more you understand how it really works. So more practice is necessary, sir.
I understand, and I do that, and I am drawn to the practice. Okay, it's not that it's a chore for me to practice.
Good. How long do you sit for?
Most of the time, when I'm 15 minutes, but then I go to a group on Saturday and Sunday. It's about 30 minutes then.
Every retreat I've ever gone to, when people asked at the end of the retreat, how long should I sit for? 45 minutes was the standard. 45 minutes. And there's something about that. When you sit for 15 minutes, 12 of those minutes are going to be junky. Maybe 2 minutes somewhere in the middle. It's going to be really on spot, right? You sit for half an hour, it'll be 20 minutes and 10 minutes of, stability in your practice. You sit for 45 minutes, it'll be 15 minutes, I mean 30 minutes rather, of stability and 15 minutes of, I mean 30, 15 minutes of stability and 30 minutes of flopping around. And I'm not saying the first minute, 30 minutes is sloppy and the rest is, stable. It's part of the mix, right? But when you go on a residential retreat, particularly for a week, the first several days it's going to be, difficult. But there's a certain point that happens the fourth or fifth day, 1 week retreat, where it all falls into place. So you're going to have, for a 45-minute sit, you're going to have 50 minutes, or maybe even the whole. I mean, you're going to have 40 minutes, or maybe even the whole 45 minutes, where it's all going to be just right. So it's a skill set.
Maybe that's what I need to do is go to immersive retreat, like you're saying.
Yeah.
Let's see. Yeah, I think I'm benefiting. And earlier somebody asked, am I doing it right? I think the answer is if you're doing it right, on a regular basis. That's my experience.
Right. Well, I would say that's true. If you're doing it right. But then the next level is how much of that allotted period of time is really doing it right and how much of it is sloppy. Right. But that's true for any skill. Playing the piano, tap dancing, knitting, whatever. Right. Other questions or comments about the Dharma, the doctrine, or your practice experience? Well, I guess that's enough for this evening. Next week, I'm going to be, in a sense, summarizing the Four Noble Truths and Noble Eightfold Path. We spent a considerable amount of time, myself and the other teachers in this group, developing the Four Noble Truths concept and practice, and the Four Foundations of Mindfulness is part of that. What I'm going to be talking about is a broad review of the principles and practices associated with the Four Noble Truths, but specifically focusing on what's called the maturation of the Eightfold Path into what's called the Tenfold Path. And I kind of touched on that a little bit this talk, but I'm going to dive in more deeply into that next Wednesday night. It's our custom at the end of our meetings for us to sit together briefly. Let's do that. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well and hope
Thanks,
you'll
Peter.
be reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to chat.
Lisa, thank
You're
you.
very welcome.
Thank you, Peter.